Welcome to the Thomistic Institute podcast. Our mission is to promote the Catholic intellectual tradition in the university, the church, and the wider public square. The lectures on this podcast are organized by university students at Thomistic Institute chapters around the world. To learn more and to attend these events, visit us at thomisticinstitute.org.
So I chose as a topic the plasma membrane because it really checks all those boxes. And the plasma membrane, the cell membrane, that edge of the cell that distinguishes or is the boundary between inside the cell and outside the cell, is not a new topic for cell biologists at all. It was first named by Carl Magley back in 1855. The concept of a cell as the unit of life actually predated that by at least 15 years. And if you press history more, you can say that idea was even emerging in the second half of the 18th century. With that, there's been a lot of study of the cell membrane, the plasma membrane. It's been a rocky road. There's been many ideas put on the table in terms of its function and its structure, and those ideas over the past 170 years have changed. And sometimes the change has been quite abrupt. And I want to give some examples of that. So we're going to see a little cell biology mixed with history as well. I think that's a condition of my undergraduate time, being a history major. Okay, so before I talk about what is the plasma membrane, also known as the cell membrane, what it's composed of, I want to talk about its function. And really, its function is that of a boundary. Again, between outside world and inside world. And I'm going to start my timer so I don't talk for 2 hours. But it's a specialized boundary. And we can think of more functions than just compartmentalizing the contents of a cell. So this boundary does function as a compartment, keeps the inside material inside, keeps the outside material outside. As a part of that boundary function, compartmentalization function, the plasma membrane also serves as an insulator. It can separate electrical charges on either side of the membrane. And that's very important for us all right now because our neurons are conveying electrical charges. And that's all due to some sophisticated membrane biology at work. This boundary is also not a total boundary between outside and inside. Cells are not islands unto themselves in the universe. They are connected with the rest of the world. So this plasma membrane, this boundary, is also a site of communication. Signals from outside the cell will impinge upon the plasma membrane. Those signals will continue through chemical reactions into the interior of the cell. And the process can work in the reverse direction as well. So there's two-way communication across that boundary. Also, the cell membrane is wonderful at being a compartment, but it's also a very porous border in many respects, though with some degree of selectivity and specificity. So the plasma membrane, this boundary, is a site of transport. There are structures within the plasma membrane that allow molecules to pass through the membrane. Some molecules pass through this membrane quite easily. Gases, for example. Oxygen, thankfully, the membrane is quite permeable to oxygen. So that is supporting life here in this room. Other molecules, if they're large molecules, they're charged molecules, have great difficulty traversing the membrane. So there's specialized structures that allow those more difficult molecules to pass in or out of the cell. So how does it do that? Well, the maxim in cell biology, and anytime you look at a problem, is function is derived from structure. And woe be to those who don't think in those terms, as I was told as a graduate student. And for the plasma membrane, what are the structures that are conferring function or functions on the plasma membrane? So we've got two categories of molecules, lipids and proteins. And the lipids are involved in the compartmentalization function of the plasma membrane, the insulative function, the communication function. Proteins, they have a role in transport across the plasma membrane, but they're also involved in communication across that plasma membrane. So I want to just, for those of you who don't think about lipids and proteins every single day, just give a little brief background. I apologize to those who do. I'm sure it's like philosophers having to listen to the four causes at the beginning of every lecture. So proteins, in this case a polypeptide, we're talking chains of amino acids. Those amino acids are chemically linked together. On the left side of this screen, there's two amino acids chemically bonded together. You can form long chains of amino acids. Those are polypeptides. And every polypeptide and protein has this extended structure. This is the primary structure. This chain of amino acids is a primary structure. Most, I should say, polypeptides can achieve higher orders of structural organization. So as atoms interact with each other through bonds along that chain, a higher level of organization appears. And this is secondary structure. And here we've got all these atoms arranged in a helix. And for simplicity, biochemists, we don't like to draw every atom in every picture. So we'll convert the picture of atoms into, for example, this helix, a ribbon. So that's a ribbon diagram. This secondary structure can interact with other secondary structures and fold upon itself. And there you have, second from the right, a folded protein. This is a tertiary level of organization. So for many polypeptides, proteins, that's it, you're done. But in some cases, different tertiary structures will come together. Each one is a subunit, they can form, as they interact with each other, a higher order structure, quaternary structure. And in this case, this quaternary structure has a gap right in the middle. And that gap is actually important for function. In the case I'm going to show you. So here we have a molecular diagram. This is a protein structure. It's a ribbon diagram, and there's different colors indicating those different protein subunits within this structure. So this structure is called a potassium channel. And essentially, this potassium channel is the passageway across the plasma membrane for potassium ions. So those ions normally aren't permeable, the membrane's not permeable to those ions. This is the way you get across the barrier. You essentially use a protein, and you use that protein as a pipe. So on the right, the blue line is the plasma membrane, the yellow is the protein pipe. And if you look at the molecular structure on the left, and if you look closely, right in the center is a gray dot. That's the potassium ion, and it is moving right through the center of the structure. These are absolutely gorgeous structures, aesthetically, but also functionally. Only potassium ions can move through the pipe. If you're too big, you can't fit through a pipe. I mean, we all have that experience with clogged drains and things like that. But this pipe is special in the sense that if you're too small, you can't pass through the pipe either. So a smaller ion like sodium is not going to make it through the pipe, only the potassium. So with the structure is imposing specificity on the function. And this function is that of transport. Now, I'm not going to give descriptions of all those other functions. I just wanted to pull this one forward. So if you want a more ecclesiastical view of this, here's a stained glass window recently produced by a retired researcher at Harvard. This is the inner core of that pipe, and the orange dots are the potassium ions moving forward. And I've embedded the stained glass window, and the manila area is a membrane outside and inside. So if there's anyone planning a new Newman Center, and you know the idea of all these windows with saints gets a little tedious, please think about saint, potassium channel, saint, sodium channel. You know, it may liven up a student's interest in faith. Okay, so let's talk about the other molecule that's really important for membranes, and I'm going to spend most of the time on these molecules. These are lipids, and there's different classes of lipids, and of course, to add to our confusion, there's different ways to classify lipids based on structure and which atoms they contain. I'm going to keep it very general, so apologies to lipid biologists in the room. There's two big classes of lipids we can talk about. We can talk about phospholipids, and we usually don't think about phospholipids over breakfast, but we do think about the other class, sterols, namely for us, cholesterol. Everybody's talking about, okay, what's our cholesterol levels and LDL levels when we get our checkups. I want to focus, though, more on the phospholipids rather than the sterols. Now, this is a diagram of a particular phospholipid, phosphatidylcholine. And what you're looking at is a shorthand way of describing the molecule. This is a line drawing, and there's some things that may seem familiar to us. We see a P that stands for phosphate, the O stands for oxygen, you got it over on the right, an N for nitrogen, and then you got a lot of little lines. So in a drawing like this, we see on the left what looks like a saw blade, two saw blades in parallel with each other. Each tooth of the saw blade, each little angle on it, that's the position of a carbon atom. And there's also some hydrogens there, but they're not drawn in. So this is a quick way of drawing the molecule. It's this structure that is so important for the higher order structure and function of the plasma membrane. So let's look at this molecule. I'm going to go back a slide here. So here, the phospholipid is sort of laying on its side. I'm going to stand it up such that the long tails are pointing downwards. And we can see that in the diagram on the left. And some additional atoms have been drawn in. This picture shows the hydrogens. So I'm looking at the structure on the left in the middle of that panel. And we can see that from it, and also biochemists have figured this out, that there are unique properties to this lipid structure. If you're in the lighter colored region where you have those long tails, and often rather than drawing out all the atoms, what cell biologists will do is show these long tails as just a line. That part of the molecule does not bond with water molecules. So biology works in an aqueous environment, at least the biology we know of. So those atoms do not like to hydrogen bond with water. So they're hydrophobic. They don't want to be in contact with water. They can't be in contact with water. The bond doesn't form. The other part of the molecule on top, if you look to the left, it looks there's a ball, that ping pong ball describes all these atoms up there. Those atoms can, some of them, form hydrogen bonds with water molecules surrounding it. So you've got one molecule with two different properties. It's both hydrophilic on top and then below hydrophobic. Well, this creates a problem thermodynamically because it's energetically unfavorable to keep hydrophobic molecules in contact with water molecules. So you have to find a favorable energy state. And the way you do that is reducing the contact of those hydrophobic long chains, those tails, with water molecules. The way you do that is you find another molecule that looks like you, and all those tails form up side by side, and they effectively begin to shield each other from water molecules in the environment. And then the whole polar head groups, or the hydrophilic head groups, are left on the water-facing surface of this aggregation of molecules. So the way you can start doing this geometrically to reduce the exposure of these long tails with water molecules is you form a sheet of lipids. And you can reduce the contact even further if you have two sheets together, one on top of the other, with those long hydrophobic tails pointing at each other. So this minimizes, again, contact between the hydrophobic tails and water molecules. So in the diagram on the right, the red regions are where you see the hydrophilic head groups, and then the little line, the middle of the sandwich, that light line, is where the hydrophobic tails are. So to reduce contact with water even more, this structure is through an energetically, thermodynamically, energetically favorable process can fold up on itself and form a perfect sphere. So that is an energetically favorable state. So now we have basically a balloon that has two layers. We're looking at a really basic version of the plasma membrane, a lipid bilayer. That's round. And there was debate on whether membranes were even made of lipids. Overton in 1895 found that substances that dissolve well in lipids and fats also pass through these boundaries well. So there was an idea that lipids are important. He was prescient. He said there's probably proteins involved too, but they didn't have direct experiments. But this idea of the membrane being a bilayer was one of argumentation. There were, in the 1930s, X-ray diffraction studies done to begin plotting out the electron densities of these lipids to see where the densest regions are, where the head groups are. It always appeared that the two lipids came together tail to tail. There was also a very famous experiment in 1925, the Gorder-Grendel experiment. Very simple. They were working with red blood cells. The researchers calculated the area, surface area, of the red blood cells, the membrane. Then they extracted all the lipids from those membranes and through some very straightforward techniques spread out the lipids such that they created a monolayer. And they determined that the monolayer of lipids, the area was twice as large as the area of the red blood cell membranes. Now, the great part of this story is they miscalculated the surface area of the red blood cells. Okay, you know, they sort of look like breath mints that are not exactly easy to calculate area. But they also somehow managed to miscalculate the surface area of a monolayer of extracted lipids. The two errors canceled out, and they got the right answer. So, but then came the 1950s, where electron microscopy was the new technique on the block, eventually blossoming into a golden age of electron microscopy in the 60s. And people would see images like this shown here. So what people would do is they would take a cell and they would slice it like a piece of bologna at the deli counter. And they'd look at the slices, and what they would find is at the very edge of the cell, between outside and inside, is you had two black lines with a white middle. Again, a sandwich-like structure. Now, people argued, okay, are the black lines proteins? Are they lipids? They weren't quite sure. All they knew is it looked like a bilayer. So that was as early as the 1950s. So that wasn't a bad idea, because back in 1935, two researchers, Davison and Dinelli, came up with what people affectionately call the protein sandwich model. So a lipid bilayer, a membrane, a biomembrane, is a bilayer of lipids. So we can see the head groups of the lipids here, and the tails here, and then in green, those are the proteins. And proteins are slathered across that lipid bilayer. This was a model that was based essentially on deriving structure from function. People knew the properties of membranes, such as the physiological properties of membranes, how molecules move through membranes, salts, for example. So they came up with this idea, and this was around for another 35 years, driving thinking. So people would look at pictures of membranes like the one I just showed you. This is what was in their mind, the protein sandwich. In the 60s, there was a gain of technology where people started looking at molecular structures in more detail. And they were also looking at cells in different ways, because people are like, oh, we have an electron microscope. We can make it, we can do this, we can do that, all these different explosions of sub-techniques. One of those techniques is a process called freeze fracture. And this was a quite laborious study where people manually looked at thousands and thousands of electron micrographs looking at cells. Now, in this technique, what you do is you take a cell or some cells and you freeze them rapidly. Then you whack them with a knife, the ice fractures, and the fracture plane moves through the sample. And what they determined is the fracture plane follows the path of least resistance, and that's actually in the membrane where those lipid tails are pointing towards each other, so right through the center of the bilayer. And in this diagram, I've got two cells in the upper left showing both leaflets or layers of lipids in the membrane. So every bilayer has two leaflets. There's cell number one and cell number two. And the dotted line is the fracture plane. So it's going between the two light blue lines, the outer leaflet and the inner leaflet of cell number two's plasma membrane. And then in this particular example, the fracture plane jumps into the membrane of an adjacent cell and goes down the center of that membrane between the two leaflets. And they would see images like those on the right. And maybe images like this get planetary scientists excited. You know, it's like there's like a moonscape rocks on it, things like that. But notice the difference. On one side, it looks more smooth than the one on the left. Now, those little bumps on the left are actually an indication of proteins that are in the membrane of within the membrane. So it's not like there's proteins slathered like peanut butter on top of a bilayer. It's actually there's proteins embedded within the lipid bilayer. So this was a major change of understanding of what's happening. So I'm going to go back, and part of that change of understanding was leading to the development of known as the Singer-Nicholson model of the plasma membrane. It came out in 1972. This was a model that took all that structural data and freeze-fracture data from the 1960s and said, this is what a membrane looks like. Major paradigm shift here, because our model now is function is going to be derived from structure. So let's figure out the structure before we think about the functions. Complete opposite of Davison and Dinelli. This model is also referred to as icebergs floating in a lipid sea. The proteins in the membrane are the icebergs, and they're just freely floating that ocean of lipids. So it also implies that these lipids can move around in the plane of the plasma membrane. They can rotate, but they can also do random walks through that leaflet, or that one of the leaflets of the plasma membrane. To this day, this is the model that predominates textbooks, and I don't know why we're 15 years out from better ideas, and this is still what's being taught to many students. So I showed you that slide. Let's look at this one. This is evidence that there is a lot of motion of lipids within the plane of the plasma membrane. This is an experiment or a technique called FRAP, fluorescence recovery after photobleaching. So what you do in these experiments is you take a fluorescent probe, a molecule, and you attach it to lipids in the plasma membrane, or maybe proteins, it could be one or the other, and you now have a cell that's covered with this beautiful fluorescence. It looks white in this image. Then you take a laser beam, you zap your cell, and the energy from the laser destroys the fluorescence. So it leaves a dark zone. So it's counterintuitive. That loss of whiteness is bleaching. So we've got in the red circle one of these bleached zones. And then very rapidly, on the order of seconds, less than a minute, notice it's very hard to see the black spot anymore.
Do you have a sense of the scale bar?
On that one, they were looking at pretty large, I would say that bleached zone's probably at least 10 nanometers. Yeah. You're right, they didn't put a scale bar on that. So this was showing that if you plot out the intensities, so if you've got intensity on the y-axis and time on the x-axis, you start at 100% intensity, you bleach, you get darker, and then over time fluorescence occurs. So the idea is molecules are moving in, lipids are moving in to that bleached region. Very consistent with the Singer-Nicholson model. But notice this line never comes back to 100%. It's not a full recovery. So that was already suggesting that the model is not perfect. There are some population of non-diffusible lipids and proteins in the plane of that plasma membrane. So, okay, we've got one of the first challenges to Singer-Nicholson. Now, working in parallel with cell biologists, but of course not talking to cell biologists who are doing like whole cell studies like this, were lipid biochemists and biophysicists. And they were literally off in different worlds and different buildings, and they didn't like to look at cells. What they like to do is create artificial membranes, essentially, artificial lipid bilayers called giant lamellar vesicles, GOVs. And what they did in these experiments is they had mixed different types of lipids together to form one of these large vesicles. This basically a balloon, where the balloon is that lipid bilayer. And what they found was that if you put different fluorescent tags on different lipids, you would expect, according to the Singer-Nicholson model, that all these lipids would be homogeneously distributed in the plane of the membrane. What they found was different lipids were found in different areas of these artificial membranes. So you've got some lipids labeled green, others red. There was not this free mixing of the lipid sea. There was actually segregation, a lateral heterogeneity, as it's termed in the field. Also, it was noticed that lipids, as they're moving around this artificial membrane, they're diffusing within the plane of the membrane 20 times faster than you see lipids moving on the surface of a cell. So the in vitro world is showing a much more different picture than what people were talking about in the in vivo experimental world. So this is the classic challenge of cell biologists, walking the line between in vitro, in test tube, data versus data derived from living cells. One would think, okay, in vivo data is the best, it's the living cell, everything's proper, it's not like you're taking an enzyme out of a cell and asking a question. But cell biologists, we depend upon in vitro approaches as well, because most of us are reductionists. And in order to understand the requirements of a process, we strip away all that seems not to be needed to see if the process or reaction continues. So we got two worlds here that we're seeing lipid bilayers quite differently. The grand concordat came actually through advances in computer science and computing power. And that allowed us to look at cells much more closely. So here are two examples of improved spatial and temporal resolution that was advanced by increased computing power. Now, resolution, ability to, in space, distinguish two objects as two objects. So there's some fluorescence micrograph, so there's molecules labeled with fluorescent markers. On the left is, that's what you would see in a standard microscope. You'd see these protein structures, these green lines. They sort of look fuzzy. If you look at the line over here, very pixelated, you know, it looks like a, you know, thick green line. Use a new technique, which was microscopy, driven by advances in computing, you can see not just one thick green line, you now have two thin green lines side by side, an improvement in resolution. So super resolution microscopy broke or cheated around a physical constraint, Abbe's resolution limit. So the rule of thumb, ballparking objects to see them as distinct objects in a microscope have to be 200 nanometers apart. So we know about millimeters, 1,000-fold smaller, micrometer, 1,000-fold smaller than that is a nanometer. So we now can see objects as distinct objects that are 5 nanometers apart, 1 nanometer apart. 200, that's no longer a limitation to us. The other change in computing power is how fast you can capture and process images. And that was important because if you're looking at events, okay, you got two objects, but you got to be able to capture pictures of them over time. And this was amazing. So if you look at the track on the right here, it looks like a squiggly line. So this is somebody following a single lipid molecule over time, and they're doing a sampling of every 33 milliseconds. So every 33 milliseconds, a picture is taken, and you can track where the little lipid has gone. It looks like a random walk, and everybody's like, oh, it's Singer Nicholson again. Well, you increase your sampling time, and you can reduce your sampling time to not 33 milliseconds, but 0.025 milliseconds. The random walk looks quite constrained. You keep sampling. It looks like that lipid is in a little black square moving around, and then occasionally it jumps into another area which looks like a little black square. So the improved microscopy allows us to track single lipids in the plane of the membrane, and improved computing power allows us to get a more accurate view on how they're moving. So this enabled, and this has been really developed in the last 15 years, a model of the plasma membrane that steps away from Singer Nicholson actually quite greatly. Before I end with that model, I just want to throw this out to you, that the structure of the membrane, it's a reminder, the structure of the membrane reflects the structure of lipids. Some lipids are contortionists. They've got those long hydrophobic tails. Well, depending what kind of bonds you find in those tails, what type of chemical bonds, those tails, rather than being long and straight, can actually be all twisty and all that. And that's good because those lipids can pack efficiently along and around the irregular surface of proteins that are within the lipid bilayer. And with that, what we have been finding as people in this field is if you, this is your protein, only certain lipids will surround your protein because they are contortionists that can fill in all the little rough surfaces of the protein and pack well. So that creates a ring, an annulus. And that annulus also then will interact with other specific lipids, such as cholesterol and other phospholipids. So how do we put this in the big picture? So I'm going to end with this picture here. So what we're thinking about as cell biologists is no longer Singer Nicholson, though you can buy $200 textbooks that claim that's true. The compartmentalized fluid or anchored picket model of the membrane. Let's look in the upper left. So here you're inside the cell and you're essentially looking up at the plasma membrane. So the plasma membrane in this picture is green. What is associated with this plasma membrane are those red globs. Those are proteins that are passing through the membrane. So if the membrane is here on me, top of me is outside the cell, my feet, the red glob is beneath the membrane. So these proteins are sticking through the membrane. These proteins are also associating with very specific lipid molecules, those that can pack well around the structure of the protein. Now, what's interesting is these molecules, these proteins, the red dots, they're just not wagging their feet down there. They're actually associating with other proteins in the cell, described here as these yellow lines. This is a network of protein polymers. And in fact, we've known about the protein for a long time in other contexts in the cell. But in this context, only in the last few years have we described these structures. So the transmembrane proteins are interacting with a network of polymers in the cell. This is immobilizing those transmembrane proteins. They cannot be icebergs floating through the lipid sea. They're fixed in place. Well, what that really creates is a fence, a picket line, where each protein is one plank in the fence. Now, you might think of, okay, Tom Sawyer painting the fence. You've got the boards. You've got gaps in the boards. Why can't molecules move through the gaps? Why aren't the lipids moving through the gaps? Remember, surrounding each protein are rings of lipids. And the physical properties of those lipids are such that they create a friction on other lipids moving through that region. So if you've got a lipid up here freely walking around, floating in that sea of lipids, if it encounters the fence and those rings of lipids surrounding the pickets in the fence, there's drag on that free-moving lipid. And essentially, it's now restricted or constrained to these open regions of the membrane. So that's just like what we saw here, where we've got a molecule over time just occupying a specific area. No free walking. But occasionally, that molecule will enter another area. That means a gap has opened up in the fence. Usually, it's thought to be stochastic. All of a sudden, you've got a space wide enough for that lipid to move through. That's a process called hop diffusion. So, taking all that together, how should we think about the membrane? Let's throw out the idea of icebergs, proteins floating in a lipid sea. Rather, I think it's more fair to think of the membrane now as a series of interconnected lakes. And, you know, Canada, Scandinavia, got a lot of lake district. The open water areas, that's where molecules can freely move. Sometimes they can cut into other areas through channels and connecting waterways, and the land is really the fence, which is immodal. Is this a perfect model? No. I can throw 10 objections at it or more, but it's better than what we had. So what we're seeing is evolution of thought, major paradigm shifts in thinking, and a lot of it has been driven always by advances in technology. And did I go over time? No. Okay.
Thank you so much. Yeah.
Thanks for listening to this lecture on the Thomistic Institute podcast. The generosity of people like you makes this podcast possible. If you enjoy these talks, please consider showing your support at www.thomisticinstitute.org/donate. Your donation of even a dollar helps us reach more college students and many others with the powerful truths of the faith, and it ensures that we can keep publishing top-notch lectures on this podcast. Thanks a lot.